is tape 3, the afternoon of January 6, 1961. President, you were going on further with Jefferson Davis.
His popularity came after the surrender, after the war was over. And during his presidency, his popularity went down all the time. He had trouble with the southern governors. He had trouble with his generals. He had trouble with the Congress. And he was not a conciliatory person. He always wanted everybody to agree with him. And if they didn't agree with him, then there was trouble. But after they surrendered, and they put him in chains, put him in prison, his popularity began to rise. And when he died, he was the most popular man in the South.
How long was he in prison?
About a year or something like that. They turned him loose. I forget exactly what the date was, but he was in Fortress Monroe, and they put him in chains. And of course,
on whose orders was that?
That is on the order of the Congress that was running the Reconstruction. That's how it came about. Nobody wanted to do it, and they threatened to put the General Lee in the same fix. General Grant, for once, rose up and said if they did that, he'd quit. He was president at that time.
So this Committee of 15 was still pretty much calling the turn during Grant's administration.
The Committee on the Conduct of the War. They went right on through and did every dirty thing they possibly could. And, of course, it wound up by making Jefferson Davis the most popular man in the South.
Now, with the carpetbaggers and the scallywags that went down there, what steps were being taken by anybody up north to curb this kind of...
They were not trying to curb it, they were encouraging it. They set up the carpetbag governments for the simple reason they wanted to keep the Republicans in control. And that's how the Ku Klux came about. They enfranchised all the Negroes in the South. And when they put in the Republican governments, why, that was exactly what old Fat Stevens and the rest of them wanted. Well, the Ku Klux came along and scared the niggers to death, and that's the way the South came back into power.
Well, actually, Grant was elected by only 300,000 votes, and there were 700,000 Negro votes that came into that particular...
That's correct. That's correct. That's the way, that's what the radicals wanted. They knew that they couldn't maintain control. But you see, in 1876, they elected a Democratic president by a tremendous majority, and then set up a commission to decide who was elected and counted the carpetbag votes, and that's the way Brother B. Hayes became president.
That's right.
I want to get back to Jefferson Davis being put in chains. What was the symbolism of the chains? Why was he put in chains?
Well, they were expecting to try and hang him, and they put him in Fortress Monroe, and there was a customary in those days. Put a fellow in chains when he'd been put in jail for a major crime, and he was going to be tried for treason. But it became such an unpopular proposition, they had to turn him loose.
When did this mellowing begin to take place up north?
Oh, it began about 1868, when Grant became president.
Grant himself took no part in any of the proceedings, excepting, as you say, when they got after Robert E. Lee. He threatened to intervene
and cause trouble, and they didn't do anything to Lee. Well, there wasn't anything they could do to Lee, except they could have put him in prison, I guess, like they did Jefferson Davis. But Lee and Joseph E. Johnson and the old man from down
Beauregard,
they didn't do anything about them, nor the fellow we were trying to think of a while ago.
Bragg.
Those were the leading generals that were then alive.
Well, in that sense, Grant can be said to have been a wise man because, as I recall, when Lee surrendered, he ordered the horses to remain with the troops.
Yes, keep their sidearms, let them go home, and take care of themselves. And he was a kind-hearted man. It was the people around him that caused him all the trouble. He didn't even know this crooked business was going on when he was president of the United States. He came darn near being elected the third time in 1880.
Well, now, the second time, he just barely squeezed through, but he made it the second time. But did he not at that time begin to get the criticism of everybody? Because it was a country without a government at that time, wasn't it, during his administration?
I don't think he paid any attention to criticism or anything of that kind. Facts in the case there, I don't think he cared much about what they said about it.
But he didn't do anything.
He'd been through the mill all the way up to lieutenant general, and they finally made him a general for life, you know, when the war was over. And he didn't care anything about anything but his military career.
Say he was impervious to criticism from any side.
That's right.
And flattery, too?
He liked flattery. All the generals do. All the generals like flattery.
But he didn't do anything as president?
No.
Was there any single act that distinguished him at all as an active instead of a passive president?
No, not that I remember of. I don't think there was any. I don't think anything that went on except the vicious reconstruction of the South.
Well, it proves a rather
he
interesting...
He never will live down, no matter how long they write history about him. He never lived that down. Because he was present when the worst part of it was going on.
Well, now, it's curious, Mr. President, that Grant seemed to prove a rather interesting theory that we're so wound up as a nation that we can coast along for 8 years without a president.
Well, he's done it recently.
Well, I'd like a little elaboration on it. Go ahead.
Then the one very serious charge against Grant is that he tolerated, did nothing at all to mitigate, even if he could, this carpet bag bagging.
I think he was for it. He was general. He conquered the place, and he thought that the conquered ought to pay the bill. That's how they had that. All had that idea as a result of the Battle of Waterloo. The way they treated Napoleon. Same thing exactly, almost. And that hadn't worn off. And same thing in the Mexican War, if you remember, when Santillana was defeated, we made the Mexicans pay through the nose. They turned us over a whole lot of land, although we gave them $15 million for it. But it was loser pay every time. And in the World War I and World War II, we didn't follow through the program.
Well, we did a little bit after World War I, but that petered out. But under your administration, in this case, the victor had paid, not the victim.
Right. Well, to some extent, that was true in the First World War. Of course, there was some attempt to make the Germans pay a penalty, but Germany was never in any way injured by the First World War. They never got inside the borders with their army. And then had their revolution, if you remember, and made their separate peace. And so they got their Alsace-Lorraine back. That's all they wanted. And that was the only reparations, I think, that came out of the First World War.
Well, we forgot to count the Dillon Reed reparations.
Except that down in Africa and the colonies, the British took over all the German colonies and were all the German colonies. The managers of one of their colonies in the Pacific, we still have it. Mark, we still have it.
Do you think that Grant understood anything at all about the functions or the theory of the presidency? Was he content to rely on advisors and go along?
I think that's exactly right. I don't think he knew very much about what the president's job was, except that he was the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. That was the thing I think it impressed him more.
Well, that leads me to this question. So having reached a certain stage after victory, whether that part of it or not, are a little bit too tired to go on to more tougher job of being a president.
Well, the administrative job of the president is the greatest job in the world. There's no greatest job of anybody else. It's a general room that approaches the responsibility and the work of responsibility. And that most of the generals have the idea that as commanding generals, they're going to retire someday to a nice post and sit there and wait for their term to end. And they think that some of them think they can retire to the White House and do the same thing. They can't.
Points well taken. But the case of General Grant, he wasn't even a ceremonial president, was he?
Well, only when he made his trip abroad. Then he became very much a ceremonial president. He made a trip abroad, you know, after he got out of office. And when he came back with the greatest of great receptions in New York and everywhere else in the country. And that's when he became a candidate in 1880 to run for president again after he made that trip abroad.
Well, he was a colorful figure anyway, with his figure anyway, with a.
Yes, except that he was only about 5 feet 6 inches tall.
That's right. Now, why did he go abroad at the time he did? Was that calculated to redeem his or restore his popularity?
I think he'd been invited by the heads of government to go abroad, and of course, they're all like the glamour of the heads of state in those days. And if I remember correctly, they had an emperor in France, and they had a queen and empress in Great Britain, and in Germany they had an emperor, and I think Grant visited them all, and they had troop reviews. He rode a horse and could be a four-star general, which is the highest rank there was in those days, and I think he enjoyed it very much.
Now, this is about the time he was doing his memoirs, or is it...
He did his memoirs after he came back. His memoirs, I think, were written in the 1880s. And he barely finished them before he died as a result of the cancer of the mouth.
Cancer of the mouth.
About the men who are around him, Mr. President, and his cabinet, were there any good men in his cabinet that you recall?
I don't remember whether John Hay was in his cabinet or not. I think, though, John Hay was the Secretary of State after Seward was out, and if that's the case, well, John Hay was a good man.
But about the rest of his cabinet, there was not.
I don't know anything about the rest of them. I have never read the history of mine. I tried to keep up with his cabinet because I didn't like what they did, and I never went into it very carefully. But we can find out who they were. But I think John Hay was his Secretary of State.
Yes. And what about?
I'm not sure about that, but I think he was.
Yes. So his administration can be really remembered, but nothing important constructively as far as.
As the administrative part of the government is concerned, that's true. And I think also it's true of the whole administration. I don't think there's anything done. And the greatest thing in connection with it were the great scandals that came out after he left office.
Yes. Well, weren't people aware of the scandals at the time? Or,
sure they were. As I say, they came very near electing him president again in 1880, in spite of.
Well, that was during that same period of Grant. This was the first time we nominated a Catholic for the presidency on some kind of a ticket. An O'Connor, a man named O'Connor.
Yes, from Virginia, from Virginia.
New York, wasn't it? Or Virginia?
I don't remember.
New York, but he was the attorney for Jefferson Davis.
Well, this is the first
the
time.
Trial, yes.
So, first time we nominated a Catholic for president.
Well, that was on a. Sort of a fringe ticket.
No, that's fringe ticket. It wasn't on a real ticket.
No. And he was the attorney, defense for Jefferson Davis.
You see, you can tell how the people were beginning to feel by the very small majority that Grant had in the popular vote the second time he was elected. And the majority that Samuel J. Tilden had in 1876, he had published for those days a tremendous majority, something like 300,000 or 400,000. And yet, they count him out because the radicals didn't want him in the White House. And he was an old bachelor anyhow, never worked very hard. When the time came for him to make a decision, he said, oh, well, no use fighting for it. I don't care anything about turning out. He's repeated the statement of Henry Clay, he'd rather be right than present.
Now, just as a passing thought, here we have a glamorous figure, as you say, a short but glamorous man, and yet he had not only a disastrous first administration, first term, but the second one was even worse.
That's right.
And yet people seem to go ahead and do it. Now, how do you, as a student of the presidency, how do you explain the action of people in face of this kind of performance?
Please hold the answer, Mr. President, until the end of this tape here. For the next one is the end of tape 3, afternoon, January 6th. This is tape 4, the afternoon of January 6th, 1961. You were asking,
Dave. Let me rephrase the question a little bit. In face of all this notoriety that seemed to follow the Grant administration, first term and second term, is it that the people are indifferent or careless or tired, or
no.
Is the presidency ahead of the people or the what?
No, it's hero worship. All the people, no matter where they come from, they like a winner and like a hero, and that work completely and nearly all the way through the history of our government, Jackson was a hero of the Battle of New Orleans. He won the only battle that was won in the War of 1812 and was the most popular man of his time, north, south, east, and west. Even Harvard had to confer a degree on him, whether they wanted to or not. And that was true of every one of these generals except Winfield Scott. He was called Old Fuss and Feathers, and he was a kind of a strutter. And the hero of the Mexican War was Zachary Taylor, because he was a common everyday fellow and had won the Battle of Buena Vista and made the famous remark to Captain Bragg, a little more grape, and won that battle and two or three others. And the same thing was true of Sam Houston in Texas. He won the Battle of San Jacinto, or however you say that, with less than half the people that Santiana had as at the battle. And he was a hero, and continued to be a hero until he was against secession in Texas, and then they almost hanged him for that. Well, same thing was true of General Grant. He was a hero of the war between the states. He was in at the surrender of Lee, and had caused the opening of the Mississippi River, and turned out to be a great field general in the military manner, and that's the reason he was so well thought of. And you'll find that there were a great many other generals who were well thought of at that time. There's a great big old six-footer who was in command of the 11th Corps at Gettysburg. He was nominated on the Democratic ticket in 1880, but the fellow running against him had also been a major general in the Federal Army, and they elected Garfield instead of Hancock. Winfield Scott Hancock was his name. He was 6 feet, 4 inches tall, weighed 230 pounds, one of the finest looking men in the United States, and is just as lazy as they make a fat man. He didn't make any effort to win, but he came very near it, even at that. And in 1888, it was a major general in the Federal Army that beat Grover Cleveland for re-election. They always charged that Grover Cleveland didn't go to war because he paid some fellow to go for him. Whether he did or not, I don't know. But it goes to show you how far glamour and how far a military record can carry a man. William McKinley was a major in the Civil War. He was elected as Major McKinley on the Republican ticket.
Now, what is that about a peaceful or peace-loving people with an advanced society, with institutions that were free, that makes them so blinded to the virtues of people?
It's not necessarily confined to the United States of America. Wellington was made the prime minister on the ground of the battle, winning of the Battle of Waterloo, and he was a perfect dumbbell when it came to administration. And Napoleon III was put on the throne in France because he knew how to wear a uniform. He thought he looked like the real Napoleon.
Well, they all like a parade, I take
it. That's the idea, exactly.
Well, but Mr. President, our people are brought up a little differently. They're brought up away from all this nonsense and all this
makes no difference.
Business.
They still like it. They've just elected one twice right now on the same basis.
this is what is there? Is it in the nature of our people, or is it the means that we employ to glamorize these people? Highly inflate them and glamorize them with publicity and all
that? I can't answer the question, but I know it's true. I know that absolutely a military career, no matter what, on what small basis it's made, on what small basis it stands, is the best asset a man can have if he wants to be elected to office in the United States of America, anywhere from constable to president.
Gosh, that's a very discouraging point of view because...
Oh, I don't think so. We've had some pretty good men with military
careers. Somehow it's going to be... You keep saying that we never had a man on... wanted to be the man on horseback, but this is a sure road to the man on horseback if and we don't look out and get caught in one of those.
The reason we haven't had men on horseback is because the military men that have been elected were civilians before they went into the military. Every one of these generals I've named to you were civilians. They were professional soldiers except... the one that's in the White House now, and General Grant, and he had retired and came back in when the war called him. He'd been living on a farm up in Illinois, and then he had a farm out southeast of St. Louis, which is now a kind of a shrine for General Grant. But the professional soldiers, the only two that I can remember who've been in the office have been Zachary Taylor and General Eisenhower. The rest of them weren't professionals. They were civilian soldiers.
May I ask, can we change the figure from a man on horseback to a man on a nuclear submarine now with a Polaris?
If he could get it into the land, he might do some good, and can't get up the Mississippi River because it draws too much water.
Well, you don't see any harm in this, or any danger, let's put it that way.
Do people seem
to gravitate to people, to men of glamour?
No, I don't. I don't see any danger in it because with our constitution and its limitations, when the time comes to eliminating, they never hesitate to do it.
But yet our great presidents were all civilian.
But they all had some. They all had some military background of some kind or other, except Woodrow Wilson.
And Roosevelt.
Roosevelt didn't have any, no.
Well, but after all, you're not eliminating. I mean, we haven't asked the question. Of course, it's important. It's important that a man have some military service.
He ought to have some knowledge of how the military works because he's going to be commander-in-chief if he's president. And it helps. I had very little. I was only a captain in the First World War, but I had studied the military program from start to finish and did know something about it. And it helped.
Yes, well, of course, and it's all right. It's honorable to have a military to serve the country militarily whenever the country's in need.
For a limited time.
That's the reason people liked it up to this time. Of course, they've been knocking them down and slandering them, and they have come to the same situation as they did after the war between the states. You find that there was nothing more thoroughly looked down on than an old soldier from about 1886 until 1900, until the Spanish War came along. I've heard my mother and father talk about the old blue coats and the old fellows in gray living off the country, and they're supposed to live, but be stealing from the treasury as long as they live. That's the attitude they take. But when the emergency comes, then there's nothing too good for a man in uniform. I know, having been a private, a corporal, and a sergeant, and a captain.
Well, then people vote for a man with a lot of reservations. They may have a lot of reservations about a hero, but they vote for him rather than for somebody that...
They take the attitude that he's willing to be shot when he needed it, and he didn't mind going up and standing between us and what was coming. Well, now, under the present situation, the most dangerous place that a man can be is behind the lines and not in front of them.
Well, the whole thing has changed.
Absolutely.
May I go back to Grant and his being reelected? Didn't the setup of the states as a result of, as you say, the freeing of the slaves and the vote of the Negroes, didn't that play a role in his reelection? Did they also?
It did in his second term. He was elected by an overwhelming majority of the all the Negro vote went for him. I think it's 700,000. If I'm not mistaken. It had not been for that, he could never have been elected. And that was the objective of old Pat Stevens and the radicals. They wanted to keep the radical Republicans in control of the government of the United States, and they succeeded in 1876. And then people began to get tired of them, just like they do any outfit that stays in too long.
But then Grant was reelected by the same Negro vote that helped, didn't it?
Oh, yes, there's no question. But if it hadn't been for the Negro vote, he wouldn't have been elected.
Well, then I'm getting back to the question which was raised here about why a man like Grant, who achieved little, was reelected. Why do the people flock against a general? I think the answer is a technical answer as well, that he had already a block of votes on which he could count, so that actually...
Well, of course, and that block of votes stayed with the Republican Party until Franklin Roosevelt came along and took it away from him. All the niggers voted the Republican ticket all the time up until 1932.
Now, that's important. That's very interesting.
We hold that for that particular historic moment, because that was the great transition
where
the Negroes went completely away from the Lincoln Association to the Roosevelt Association.
I know, but that also explains why the Republicans had continued in power so long, and why Grant was reelected, not merely because he was a general of popular, because he had that block of votes.
But in 1876 and in 1884, that didn't do him any good, because the Democrats were really elected in 76, and the Democrats were elected in 1884. And Lincoln was, or I mean, Cleveland was really elected in 1888. But they counted him out by an electoral change around, just like they did in 76. And then Cleveland was reelected in 1892. And then he had a terrible time with strikes and all that. The soldiers and fired on them, and then the great corporations were then beginning to get control of the economic situation in the government. You remember the cry in 1896 was full dinner pail, and that's how they got elected.
Well, in a large sense, we were just during the Grant period and immediately preceding him, not only recovering from the war between the states, but we were still undergoing as a nation an evolving, maturing, rounding out process.
That's
we?
Correct.
Sort of growing up, weren't we?
Going from an agrarian state to an industrial state. That's what we become.
It was in the next 30 years or so that the real industrial revolution began to shape up.
That's true.
And that was the period of our greatest growth, greatest development.
That's right. The last 40 years.
Now, that's as we approach the 20th century. But Grant's contribution was nil, as we get to summing it up. He made no hits, a great many errors, but they were not fatal. Was that
right? I think that's true. I don't think he intentionally tried to do what was wrong, but he didn't intentionally try to do anything that was right either.
Well, but he was totally unsuited for the office and was inept as president both terms.
Well, that's my opinion of any military man, a professional military man that tries to be president.
And then if you were to go on record with any, declaration of personal opinion on the question of suitability for the presidency, you would exclude military men?
I would, professionals. Not a man with military experience, but professional military men who have spent their lives as generals. That's the
military experience is even desolatory experience is even desolatory. A man who's so conditioned that he is a professional to the word. Not so.
We've never tried. We've never had an admiral for a president.
Well, we've been a sea power. We've been a sea power.
I think people didn't understand sea power until the last year to find out what it was all about. And we've never had an admiral that was glamorous enough to get himself numb.
Well, we seem to have exerted a great deal of sea power during that period. Though.
Yes, but we got late. Only one war, and that's Andrew Jackson, New Orleans.
This is the end of tape 4, the afternoon of January the 6th.